Okay, bring the meeting to halfway order until we get a quorum. We got a quorum?
Yep.
Bring the meeting together, the Public Safety Policy and Finance Security Committee, and start out with a roll call.
Representative Cornish.
Here.
Representative Johnson.
Here.
Representative Hillstrom.
Here.
Representative Becker Finn.
Here.
Representative Considine. Representative Dean. Representative Frankie.
Here.
Representative Gossel.
Here.
Representative Howe. Representative Lomer. Representative Lucero.
Here.
Representative Neuberger. Representative O'Neill. Representative Pinto.
Here.
Representative Ward.
Here.
Representative Zerwas.
Okay, we have a motion from someone to approve the meeting minutes for February 2nd.
So moved.
Representative Pinto moves the minutes for February 2nd. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Okay, motion carries. Today we have Guardian Ad Litem Board review and Suzanne Allegro, State Program Administrator.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. We're having a little bit of a A little bit of a problem trying to get the PowerPoint to work. But I could go ahead without it.
Sure. I'll be ready.
Okay. Thank you for the opportunity to present the State Guardian Ad Litem Board budget. Our base budget in 2000 and FY16 was a little over $14 million. For FY17, the base is $15,289,000. Most of the, what I just wanted to point out, I've broken out the operating expenses and the personnel. Included in the operating expenses would be things like mileage, given that our guardians do need to travel to visit children either in placements or in the home. That's a fairly substantial part of the budget. We do have a contract with State Court Administration for finance and IT services. We do have some contracts with attorneys, child development consultants, IPWA consultants, and also supplies. This also included in operating, we do have a number of employees that do home office, and included in the operating would be the home office expenses. The personnel is consists of 206.62 full-time equivalent positions. That translates into we have about 246 employees. We do have a number of full-time employees. We also have part-time employees. What we do is we do have cases in every county in the state, so we do try and tailor the full-time equivalent to the number of cases in the particular county. One of the things that I did want to point out is our increased juvenile filings. This is what's impacted the program the most over the last couple of years, that since FY11 through FY16, we've experienced almost a 60% increase in the number of child protection cases. Some of this certainly probably is due to the recommendations from the Governor's Task Force on Child Protection. In addition to the increased filings, and maybe because of the number of cases in the system, the cases are also taking longer to reach permanency. So that doesn't so that does mean that we don't have guardians getting off cases as quickly as they did in the past and freeing them up to be assigned to new cases. Not every single county has experienced a caseload increase, but most of the districts have. And some of the biggest caseload increases have been in Ramsey and Hennepin counties, and also in the 7th District, which includes Stearns County. The governor's budget recommendations include a base budget in FY18 of $17,651 and in FY19 $18,417. The increase is due to three change requests, and I'll talk a little bit about each one of them. The three are employee compensation, guardian ad litem positions, new positions, and insurance and retirement increases. That would be the employer's share. The employee compensation request includes a little under $1.6 million for across-the-board salary increases. That would be for 2 years, for the 2 years, and then $1.470 for pay parity. What's included in the across-the-board salary increase, we have asked for a 5% across-the-board increase. Part of the reason for this amount is that in the last biennium, the guardian ad litem employees only got we only got money for a 2% increase, while the other judicial branch employees got a 4%. Additionally, I believe most of the executive branch employees did get at least a 2.5, so we did get a lower cost of living increases. We simply didn't have the money to give them that amount of a cost of living. In addition to the lower cost of living, nobody in the program has received either a step or merit increase since 2009. The cost for the pay parity is basically a little under half of our guardians are at the beginning of the salary range. And again, this is due to money that we were not able to place the guardians where they should be on a salary range due to the lack of money. So we have guardians with number of years experience making the same amount of money as a new employee. And again, we don't give salary, we haven't given any merit or step increases. So we hope to reduce turnover and ensure that we keep trained and experienced guardians ad litem. Our next request is for 10 new guardian ad litem positions, and this is basically to deal with the increase in the child protection filings. We do have both federal and state mandates that we need to comply with. A judge must order the appointment of a guardian ad litem in a juvenile case where the child is alleged to be abused and neglected, and this is both according to federal and state mandates. There are several things. When the program started to experience the increased filings, there were several steps that the program took. We did convert some administrative positions to guardian positions. The board did have to implement a case prioritization policy that basically said with limited resources, child protection cases would get assigned first, and then we would assign other cases after that. Due to this policy, over the last couple of years, we have very much decreased the amount of resources we devote for the to family court appointments, which has raised some concern among the bench. We also have used temporary positions, and then we do have some of our part-time employees. We have assigned them cases, if possible, over there. Assigned full-time equivalent position, and then we also have managers and coordinators who are taking cases. And our last increase is for employer-paid insurance increases and employer-paid retirement costs, and we ask for this so that we don't avoid any reduction in guardian ad litem services.
Members, Representative Considine and Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is the starting salary for a guardian ad litem? I don't see that anywhere.
It is a little under $19 an hour, and it translates into, on a yearly basis, a little under $40,000 a year.
Thank you.
Representative Ward and then Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You did talk about the increased filings in the chart numbers, page 7. And I just wondered if you could go, yes, that one. I'm not sure I completely understand why the increase is there. You said some cases were taking longer, and you said something about the governor. I guess it went too fast for me. Could you kind of break that down again, why we're increasing so much?
Ms. Allegro?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ward. Basically, what we do believe, and this has also been experienced by the courts and the social service agencies around the state, that due to the heightened awareness in child protection matters that was brought about by the governor's task force on child protection cases and a change in how cases were screened, we are seeing more cases now go to court. And so when the case does go to court, due to, again, federal and state mandates, the judge must appoint a guardian ad litem if the child is alleged to be abused or neglected. So we have seen pretty much since starting a little bit in FY14, continuing into FY15, and continuing into FY16, a greater increase in the number of orders we get from the court in child protection matters for which we need to appoint a guardian.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Warren.
Just to clarify then, we're identifying more kids now. Not that the incidents have gone up that much, but what you're saying is that we're identifying them better and differently than what we have in the past because of the information we now have. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ward, that's probably correct. I maybe don't have all the answers as to sort of why it's gone up, but certainly, yeah, we are identifying differently. As I said, the screening criteria changed, which, again, more cases, other cases that were handled outside the court system are now being handled inside the court system. And then the other issue that I maybe ran over too quickly is that, again, the cases are not getting disposed of as quickly, and that may be just because there's simply more cases in the system. There's more of a demand for services. We're seeing waiting lists and that type of thing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a comment on that, that was in a Health and Human Services Committee maybe a couple weeks ago now, and the Commissioner of DHS was talking about there being more cases reported, but also the screening that many fewer cases going to what's called family assessment instead going through the court system. My question on this slide is, it says juvenile court filings. Are these child protection cases specifically, or does it include juvenile delinquency cases as well?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto, this is child protection cases. We do some juvenile delinquency cases, but they're very few.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you've got this, the later slide talking about the position request, saying that there's been an increase of 60%, which makes sense, since 2011. What is what's the equivalent figure for the staff then? If you get the 10 positions, how will the your total FTEs have increased? I assume the increase since 2011 will not have been 60% in FTEs, if you can comment on that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto, we currently have about 203 employees that are in a guardian ad litem position. That may not be full-time. Again, that's bodies, and some of them may be they may be characterized as, we have special guardians that handle Indian child welfare cases, so some of them would be in that classification. We also have some lead workers, but it would pretty much be an additional 10 positions to that 203.
Mr. Chair, I guess what I'm asking is the number of cases has jumped 60% from 2011 until now. So what was the number of FTEs in 2011 as compared with, what would the corresponding percentage increase be from 2011, if you understand my question?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pinto, I don't have the figure from FY11. I'd have to get that.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I'd love to get that. Have a sense. As I say, my guess is it's nowhere close to 60%, and it seems like that would be helpful to then help to provide some justification. What my guess is a very very well-founded request. I would love to see how the staffing compares. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Lohmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Allegro. I just want some clarification. Is it true that some of the guardian ad litems are volunteer positions and some are paid? Is that correct?
Representative Cornish, Mr. Chair, and Representative Lohmer, that's correct. We use volunteers in Hennepin and Ramsey County on child protection cases. And we do have, I think we have a little over 320, I believe, right now.
Okay, thank you. And then do you have, I guess I'm wondering about their training, and do you have costs associated with training the volunteers, or how does that work?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lohmer, the guardian ad litem volunteers would be trained in exactly the same manner as the employee guardian ad litems. We do require a 40-hour training, initial training, before they do take any cases. Additionally, they are subject to the continuing education requirements. The only difference would be the volunteers would have 12 continuing education credits required a year, where the employees would have 15. And they also, in those particular counties, they do bring the volunteers in on a fairly regular basis. One of the things I would say, there has been some discussion, and we currently do have the National Center for State Courts under contract with us to look at the program organization, because one of the issues is whether the volunteers, whether that we should continue on with the volunteers, go to strictly employees. And part of it is the volunteers are not necessarily a less expensive way to go, that we do require more attorney representation with the volunteers. You know, the turnover, it's not like years ago. The turnover is fairly, they stay with us a couple of years, and so we do end up training. They don't stay as long as an employee, for example. So that's one of the areas we are taking a look at.
Thank you.
And Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I have seen a judge appoint a guardian in a case where the child was unborn. Do you have many of those cases where the guardian is appointed when the parent is still pregnant?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, no, I have not, and I'm not aware of that case either.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Allegro, we talked in my office the other day about some of the qualifications. Do the volunteers meet that same criteria?
Ms. Allegro?
Mr. Chair, Representative Considine, yes, they do.
Thank you.
Members, any questions? Okay, thank you very much,
thank
Ms. Allegro. Now, next up, we have the Tax Court Budget Review and Chief Judge Joanne Turner.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning.
Members of the committee. We may or may not be able to get the PowerPoint to work, but you should have copies of our presentation in your packets.
All right, you can start out with your name and title and begin.
My name is Joanne Turner. I'm the Chief Judge of the Minnesota Tax Court, and with me today is Lisa Peister, our longtime court administrator. On behalf of the court, thank you for the opportunity to present today.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Could you pull your mic a little bit closer, please?
Is that better?
Yeah.
I normally don't need miking. Having been a teacher all those years. Yeah.
You guys can have a question.
That was our problem to begin with.
Oh, you didn't have your dad here?
No.
We'll see if I can find
something. Okay. All right. Once again, thwarted by technology. In our first presentation a couple of weeks ago, we briefly explained what the tax court is and what it does, and there's a couple of slides in your packet to remind you of that, those things. Again, we are an independent trial court within the executive branch. We were established by the legislature to hear only tax-related cases. We hear two types of those cases, challenges brought by property owners to property tax assessments. That's about 98% of our load. And challenges brought by taxpayers to orders of the Commissioner of Revenue for payment of a wide variety of other state-administered taxes. That amounts to about 2% of our load, depending on the year. The point I want to emphasize is that by the time the case is filed in our court, the taxpayer has already been ordered to pay the tax. They're either under an order of to pay property tax or an order of the Commissioner to pay some other type of tax, and that order stands unless and until we rule otherwise. In that respect, we are not part of the tax administration system, nor are we part of the tax collection system, but as I'll explain, we make both of those things work more efficiently if we work more efficiently. Uh, In the 4 years that Judge Dela Pena, Judge Haluska, and I have been on the court, we have accomplished those goals. We are more efficiently handling our property tax cases, and that means counties pay less interest on property tax refunds. They're better able to budget and forecast because they're not paying refunds from long-ago assessments with current tax dollars. And if we can reset property values appropriately, then taxpayers don't have to protest their taxes in the first place. On the commissioner's side, if we can resolve cases more quickly, then taxpayers pay less interest to the state. State does can do a better job of budgeting and forecasting in some very small respect. And we can more quickly resolve cases that pose the same legal issue. We are entirely funded by the general fund. Although we generate filing fees annually, depending on the number of cases filed, those filing fees are all deposited into the general fund. In the past year, with about 3,000 cases filed, that amounts to about $1 million in filing fees. When our caseload peaked at just under 6,000 filings a few years ago, of course, we generated substantially more than that in fees. When Judge Dela Pena and I first sat before this committee in 2013, we were a very different court. We had ongoing budget problems to the point that the court nearly shut down because of a mid-year rent increase that it could not pay. We printed on both sides of the paper, not because of concern for the environment, but because we couldn't afford to buy any more paper until July 1st. The legislature, you folks have been good to us, and we have appreciated the extra funding. We've put it to good use. Our current appropriation for this fiscal, this current biennium is just under $4 million. That includes a lot of one-time money for case management system, for replacement of our phone system, redevelopment of our website. The 2000 bill passed in May set our base appropriation for 2018-19 at $1.392 million annually, and that's the figure I'll be referencing in my discussions about our budget requests. Let me get caught up with myself here. You've got a pie chart in your materials, but I've got it broken out a little more easily to read here. Our personnel costs are about 72% of our budget. Rent and utilities are about another 8%. IT services, about 3%, and that leaves us about 17% for other operating costs. 4 years ago, when I spoke with you, we had a grand total of about $30,000 after paying for salaries and rent to do everything else we had to do. We are in a much better position today. And again, I thank you for that. Let's break those down a little bit more. Our personnel costs. We have three judges. That number is set in statute. It has to be an odd number because we have the ability to sit on bunk. Our salaries are also established by statute at a percentage of what a district court judge makes, 98.52% to be exact. We understand that the judicial branch is requesting an increase of 3.5% for its district court judges. If the legislature agrees, our salary costs will increase by that same percentage. And the governor is requesting a small increase in our base appropriation for those increases and for the associated pension and benefit costs. We have three administrative staff. Our court administrator, Lisa, who is here today, that position is established in statute. Lisa manages our calendars and our budget. We have an administrative assistant who processes incoming cases and processes settlements and dismissals of existing cases, and she is also the voice and the face of the court. She's the person that you call if you've got a question about something you got from the commissioner or something you got from the county on your property tax cases, on your property tax bill. And she works with the counties to ensure that settlements are properly documented, that we have all the information we need in order to enter cases into our case management system. And we also have a paralegal who maintains our case files, maintains our library, makes our decisions available to the public on our website and through Lexis and Westlaw. And then we have three law clerks who do basic legal research for us. They assist in drafting decisions and orders. And they also act as our bailiffs or courtroom deputies, meaning they open the courtroom for us, and they also act as liaisons between us and the parties during trial. And they are generally just another set of eyes and ears when we are in trial. We have one additional personnel cost that could arise this fiscal year and in the next biennium. As I mentioned 2 weeks ago, Tom Haluska was not reappointed to our court. The cases currently assigned to him have to be reassigned. A number of those cases cannot be reassigned to the incoming judge, Tamar Granvall, because she represented the Commissioner of Revenue in those cases before us. So they will have to be split between Judge De La Pena and I. If, although we are an executive branch court, we're subject to the rules of civil procedure, meaning we give the parties the right to strike the assigned judge. If the case is reassigned to me and a party strikes me, and the case is reassigned to Judge De La Pena and the other side strikes him, we have no one left on the court who can hear it. In that situation, you folks have provided that we can hire a retired district court judge or a retired tax court judge to hear the cases, but we have to pay them the difference between what they get as pension and our salaries. I don't yet know if that circumstance will arise. I've not yet begun to reassign Judge Haluska's cases. So I don't know if we will need to exercise that option or in how many cases we will need to exercise it. However, for perhaps the first time in a very long time, I'm able to tell you that whatever that expense is, we'll be able to cover it within the 2018-19 case appropriation. Rents and utilities make up about 8% of our budget. We are chambered in the Minnesota Judicial Center. We have been chambered there since the building opened. And that's also where we have a small trial courtroom. Our rent is established by the Department of Administration. We have not yet been told what our rent will be for 2018-19, but we reasonably expect it will go up for a couple of reasons. One, we haven't had a rent increase in a while. And number two, for the first time in almost 20 years at least, we are getting new carpet. And sooner or later, that's going to show up in our rent. In addition, in the situation I just described, if we have to hire a fourth judge to hear cases because of conflicts, we will have to find chamber space for that judge someplace, and that will probably mean renting some space from the Court of Appeals elsewhere in the building. But whatever those costs may be, whatever the rent increase is or the cost of housing that fourth judge, we will be able to cover that within our base appropriation. IT costs. They amount to about 3% of our budget. We pay central minute for things like email, phone system, computer router that gives us desktop access to the web, all of that amounts to about $22,000 a year. I need to correct something I told you 2 weeks ago. 2 weeks ago I told you that we were using Minute for all of our desktop support except for the case management system. And I learned the hard way a week and a half ago that's not true. Minute is not providing us with desktop support yet. but they were in our space yesterday meeting with us, surveying our equipment, and they're telling us that by June 30th, we will be taking desktop support from them. The good news is we haven't been paying them to do it yet. We still pay an outside consultant for that. Our existing case management system license is about $4,000 a year, and we budgeted about $9,000 for hardware replacement. We have not yet done that because of problems with that old existing case management system, which runs on an old operating system. We anticipate that if we can go live with the new case management system by June 30th, we will be able to do that on new hardware for staff. And then that leaves us about 17% to do everything else we have to do, postage, travel to hear cases, buy supplies and equipment, buy Westlaw, keep our library current. We also are required by statute to pay for transcripts for taxpayers who cannot pay them, receive some form of government assistance. By statute, they're entitled to have those costs paid, out-of-pocket costs paid by us. We have four budget requests, one ongoing, two ongoing, and then two one-time requests. We had about $1.4 million in our current appropriation for acquisition of the case management system. Once we go live, we'll have to pay to keep it running. So we're asking for funds to pay that annual license fee, to pay for hosting the software and the database somewhere. In addition, Minute is requesting a half-time employee be assigned to that software, and we are asking for funds to add a full-time person in-house at the tax court. There's already $144,000 in our 2018-19 base for the case management system, for operation of the case management system. That estimate, of course, was before we knew who the vendor was going to be or what the software was going to be. So the ask is really the difference between $400 and $144 or $256 a year. That, again, will cover the annual license fee, cost to host it, cost to keep the database secure, and so on, and it'll also allow for hiring of 1.5 FTEs. I'll have more detail about that in the next slide. We're also asking for money in a one-time appropriation for rulemaking to permit electronic filing. And if I can briefly explain, we have rulemaking authority under our current statute. We would much rather implement electronic filing by procedure rather than administrative rule. To do it by administrative rule is cumbersome. It takes a long time. If we need to make changes because there's been a change in the way the software works, we've got to go back to rulemaking again. But we don't have authority in statute to do it by procedure. So we have a legislative proposal that would add that language to Chapter 271, just much as the Office of Administrative Hearing did it last year to facilitate their new case management system. If we can get that statutory amendment, then we won't need the money for rulemaking. So right now, that's essentially a placeholder. So honing in a little deeper, drilling a little deeper on the ask for the new case management system. Again, there's already, without a specific earmark, $144,000 in that 1.392 base for operation of the case management system. Our annual license fee is about $100,000 a year for the case management system. We have to pay to host it. We've got to pay to host the database, and that includes all the security that comes with it. Minute is requesting a half payment of a half-time employee, and then we'd like to add a full-time court employee. And let me briefly explain why we need somebody if Minute also has somebody. The way this case management system will work when we get to electronic filing, you as a taxpayer it will look to you as though you are sending your document directly into the new case management system, but that's not really what will happen. Because of the chance of viruses and malware and Trojan horses and all those things, when you file a document in our case, new case management system, it will actually go into a holding area. And while it is in that holding area, then someone from our court has to look at the document, has to make sure that it doesn't have a virus in it, that it's not full of malware, but also that the person who filed it is authorized to file it, that it's headed for the right case, it's aimed at the right place in the case management system, that it's formatted correctly, all of those things. That's not really something that a Minute employee can do. With all due respect to them, they don't know our court rules. They don't know our cases. That job really has to be done by somebody who works for our court. In addition, and that's got to be done for every document that's filed with the system all the time. In addition, we'd like that full-time employee to take over maintenance of our new website, which right now is being done by the three judges ourselves. We need somebody who's going to work with taxpayers who are filing things new electronically for the first time. Over time, we think that new position can be combined with that of our existing paralegal. But for the first couple of years here, while the system is new for us and new for our taxpayers and for the counties and agencies that are filing electronically, we need to have somebody on our staff who can manage the system. That's why we're asking for that money. And also they need to review to make sure that, for example, all confidential information has been stripped out of the filing. So they've got to make sure that all Social Security numbers have been stripped out of returns, that there aren't any account numbers left in attachments and things like that. So it will be a relatively time-consuming job for a while. Over time, we hope that our audience will become better trained in how to use the system. And again, we'll be able to combine that with our paralegal position going forward after our initial rollout. So those are our budget requests. I'm more than happy to answer questions. What additional can I tell you?
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering how many of these documents are you getting on a daily basis or a weekly basis? I'm just trying to kind of wrap my mind around all the parameters that you just said that before you can accept a document.
Right. Well, if we are... I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Representative O'Neill and Mr. Chairman. The documents that will have to be reviewed before they can go into the system, if we're able to fully implement e-filing, for example, it will start with the initial petition. So we have 3,200 of those a year. So that's at least 3,200 documents that will have to be reviewed. Each settlement will have to be reviewed. That's another, even if nothing else happens in the case, it gets filed and then immediately gets settled. That's 6,000-7,000 documents a year. Each document that's filed after that, if it's an answer in a commissioner case, if it's a motion, all the attachments to it will have to be reviewed. So in a commissioner file, for example, these are disputes over taxes that are administered by the state itself. We get a notice of appeal from the taxpayer that has attached to it whatever the document is from the Commissioner of Revenue that they're complaining about. That document typically has Social Security numbers on it, taxpayer ID numbers on it. It may have account numbers. All of those things have to be reviewed and stripped out. The Commissioner of Revenue then files what's called a return and answer. And the answer looks just like what it is. It's, you know, here's how I respond to each of your paragraphs in your answer. But then they attach copies of everything in their file, which is all the tax returns, all the submissions, all the correspondence. And that can be anything from that thick to that thick. So we are, I mean, if you figure 3,200 cases a year minimum, even if nothing else happens in any of those cases, it's 6,000-7,000 documents a year. It's hard to estimate, but by that alone, we could be talking 10,000 documents a year that have to be reviewed, which was a very long answer to a very large number.
And Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to, could you explain or go a little bit deeper into what's the process driver behind stripping all of the sensitive information? In other words, who handles the documents under the current process, under the non-electronic? Is that something that's already done? Because you must receive documents that are in paper form that contain equal sensitive data. And so, again, what's the current process, who handles it, and what's the driver behind that?
Judge?
Chair Cornish and Representative Lucero, right now, that's done manually by staff, or actually we had a court-wide redacting party a few weeks ago. We all sat around in the courtroom with magic markers and correct tape and blacked out Social Security numbers and account numbers. The authorization for doing that, the requirement to do that, is found in the Data Practices Act. Social Security numbers are the only things that by statute we are allowed to redact beyond the general provision in data practices, which allows and requires us to remove things from documents that can be viewed by the public if there's information in them that will facilitate something like identity theft. So that's the reason for which, for example, we will go through a tax return page by page to check to see that there are no account numbers sitting in there that someone can, if someone came to our window, for example, and asked to see the file, would they be able to copy an account number out of it?
Reverend Lucero?
Okay, and one follow-up then. So the driver, if I'm understanding correctly, is that documents that are processed by your court are then, at least in some capacity, available to the public or other parties, and therefore you need to redact this information. Is that correct?
Judge?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lucero, that's exactly correct. All of our proceedings are public, and all of our files are presumptively public. So in theory, anyone can come to the window and ask to see our file on any case. And we do routinely get requests for files. Somebody, for example, might have a similar issue pending and asked to see what's been filed in a case so far, or you might have an attorney who's been asked to take on a case and will check to see what's been filed with us so far.
Representative Sarah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just one quick follow-up to comment then. So I understand that there was a recent select committee, I think, of technology and creating greater efficiency within government, something to that effect. And this seems like an area that there would be a great opportunity to see if there is any ability to further automate the process rather than having a person go through, manually sift through all these documents to redact, because it is absolutely important to redact sensitive information, but doing it with a person through thousands or potentially tens of thousands of pages just doesn't seem very efficient. So, again, I see a potential area for opportunity to automate that to increase efficiency. Thank you.
Could I follow up, Mr. Chair? And, Chair Cornish and Representative Lucero, there actually is a software program we can add to our new case management system that will do that for us automatically and electronically. So we can take the raw document, we can literally point and shoot, point and click, and the software will black it out and then resave the document masked. So we'll actually have it in two formats. We'll have it in a public format with the identifiers blacked out if a member of the general public wanted to see it, but we will be able to retain a copy for our in-house use with all that information available to us. But that's something that our current case management system can't do, but we can do that as an add-on to the new one.
Members, questions? Are you finished?
I am, thank you.
Okay, well, I thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you so much.
Next, we have the Uniform Law Commission Budget Review, Michelle Timmons and
really
Bob Timmons.
We need to sign it.
Members, if you want to follow along in the budget books. There isn't a separate handout, so you can tab through and find them. Uniform Law Commission Budget Review. Go ahead, sir, with your name and title and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Bob Tennyson. I'm an attorney in Minneapolis, and I'm a member of the Uniform Law Conference. I'm a Minnesota appointee, and Michelle Timmons.
And Mr. Chairman and members, I'm Michelle Timmons, former reviser of statutes and now continuing on as a Uniform Law Commissioner.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you, Michelle Timmons, made a presentation to you a few weeks ago, so I think you're familiar with what the Uniform Law Conference does. But just briefly, we're a national organization. Each state appoints commissioners. We draft the uniform acts for adoption by the states. And we play an important role in the federal system by providing smart resources to the states for them to adopt and to facilitate interstate commerce. And we work in the areas where uniformity or commonality is very important for commerce, for family law, and many other things. We're an agency that has no employees, we have no office, we have no equipment, we have no supplies, we ask for none. We have two items in the budget. One is the annual dues to the national conference, and the other is the statute requires us, and the rules of the conference require the commissioners to attend the annual meeting. The annual meeting is roughly a week long, and in that time we review all of the acts that are being presented. They're read line by line, debated on the floor, and only after that is an act is read twice, two different years, line by line, is it approved by the up for a vote by the conference. And Mr. Chairman, that's what we do. I could talk a lot longer if you'd like, but our budget's very small. It's the two items cover their annual travel expenses for the annual meeting, and it covers part of the travel expenses of the annual meeting, because the annual meeting costs us more than that. But, and then the dues to the conference.
Any members, any questions? Thank you for being brief.
You're welcome.
Appreciate the testimony.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Okay, our last ones up today is the Board of Private Detectives and Protective Agents Budget Review. Greg Cook, Executive Director. Mr. Cook, if you want to begin with your name and title and begin however you would like.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Greg Cook, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Private Detectives and Protective Agents. As our budget is fairly simple, I have a very brief presentation. You have some handouts that I've given to you, and I only have a couple of slides to go through. Our agency is appropriated $189,000 a year, and all revenue is deposited into the general fund. The revenue comes from application fees, license fees, renewal fees, officer change fees, penalties, administrative fees, and we currently do not charge for any training certification. This slide displays some of our projected expenditures starting July 1st, 2017. To summarize, after all employee costs, we're left with about $9,000 for our fixed and variable costs. Some of these fixed expenses include our board member expenses. They get a per diem and mileage for monthly meetings, software licensing, mail services, IT expenses, some database subscriptions, and we currently are leasing a scanner for a large data project we're working on. Some of our variable costs include supplies, computer hardware, software, training, travel expenses, and then there's some unknown fees that could pop up as such, legal fees for Office of Administrative Hearings. I've taken some of these expenditures and replaced them on a simple pie chart. As you can see, the numbers are fairly evenly distributed, with the expenses to the board's numbers taking up a majority of those. This is our current fee schedule, and the fees for our licenses range from $800 to $1,900, depending on what type of license one is getting. with renewals every 2 years, ranging from $540 to $1,160, depending on how many employees a license holder has. It is worth noting that our state has some of the highest fees for licenses in the country.
Can you back up on here? I know this is a budget portion, but I was just wondering if you could explain what a protective agent is able to do and if they're able to be armed in their powers.
Mr. Chair, thank you. So a protective agent can be many things. It's a security guard you see standing post. There's armed and there's unarmed. Armed security guards have more criteria and requirements. They have to take 6 hours of initial training plus 6 hours continuing every year after that. We have some that specialize in bodyguards, executive protection, armored car, things like that.
Okay, you mentioned armored guards, security guards. There's a whole bunch of different terms there. Are these the actual descriptive job classifications you see here, and security guards would fall under them, or security guard another classification yet?
Mr. Chair, I think what you might be seeing is we have three different types of licenses. There's an individual, a partnership, and a corporate. So somebody can get an individual protective agent or a private detective license, and that's sort of a sole person getting that license. A corporate is sort of under a corporate entity, and partnerships fall under the business partnership sort of description.
Okay, so if somebody wanted to be a bodyguard for Prince or somebody or whatever, well, that's a bad name to use. Yeah, if they would have wanted to be, which one would you fall under? To be armed and be a bodyguard for somebody, some celebrity?
Mr. Chair, you could actually be in all three. You can be a sole proprietor and have a corporate license. Some people like to get the corporate license because it's an added layer of protection for liabilities. Some people like the individual license just because of the simplicity of it. So anybody could get that. And a bodyguard could work for somebody for a corporate license holder and be an employee of theirs.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom, then Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in order for them to carry, do they have to have a permit to carry, or are they licensed in some other fashion, more like a peace officer who then is licensed to carry the firearm?
Mr. Cook?
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative. There is another statute out there. I don't have the statute number in front of me, but in essence that says if anybody's going to be carrying a firearm, they have to have a permit to carry first and foremost. So before our armed guards could actually be working in armed detail, they're going to have a permit to carry along with our criteria and requirements to provide that service.
All right, thank you.
Okay. Representative Ward.
Thank you. Kind of along that same line, what kind of background checks do you do?
Mr. Cook.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you very much. Currently for license holders, what we do is a BCA statewide background check, and then, of course, we do our own sort of search, if you will, through the Internet and anything else we could find. On the other hand, so we just to make it clear, we do not do an FBI background check on people applying for a license. For license holders who are hiring employees, they do have to do an FBI background check and BCA on all their employees.
Okay, thank you, Representative Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if I'm an employee of a corporation, the corporation has to get their license, and then I have to get my individual license, or do I fall under the corporate license?
Mr. Cook.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you very much. The you can be an employee under a license holder. We do not issue separate, say, guard cards, such as they do in Wisconsin. So every individual security guard in Wisconsin actually has to have a guard card and sort of a separate type of license. We simply license the license holder who can employ as many employees, i.e. security guards, as they want.
Okay. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you. This next slide, again, some simple graphs. It kind of shows our revenue back to 2000, and as you can see, there is a general increase. Staffing, again, very simple. Last year, I was able to bring on an administrative assistant. That brings our staffing level, including me, up to two. This is some information that I provided the last time I presented to you. Slight update, we actually had a board meeting in between the last time I spoke to you, and we now are up to 353 license holders. And this is a 24% increase going back about 4 years. But again, I do want to emphasize the number of employees they have, which is 9,000. So we actually regulate 9,000 employees. And for those employees, we do have to make sure they have their background done. And going back to one of the representative's questions, it is incumbent upon the license holder to do that background, and we make sure they do it. We have to make sure they have their training. We have to make sure they have their ID card issued. To get a sort of an idea of the growth of the industry in regards to jobs, this just goes back a couple years worth of quarters, but as you can see, the industry is growing. And as promised, very brief presentation. I'll take any questions at this time.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You had mentioned that you'd added an administrative assistant, and when I look at the budget, it seems that there's a pretty significant spike for your estimate for fiscal year 17, and then it drops back down in the forecasted base. Can you talk about what those sort of added costs would have been in adding an administrative assistant person moving forward?
Mr. Cook? Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not exactly sure what you're talking about.
Mr. Chair, I'm looking at the budget, which is in our budget book.
Okay. Mr. Chair, so going back in history a little bit, prior to this last biennium, our budget was $120,000, and we didn't have enough funds to hire an administrative assistant. I had been working with interns and temporary workers. I still utilize interns. And then the last biennium, we were approved for $65,000. In order to hire on an administrative assistant, so that would have been the spike I think you're looking at.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and to that point, it shows an estimate of 226 in 17, and then it drops back down to 189, and I guess I'm curious, it jumps from 150 to 226, and then it drops back down to 189, and I'm wondering if there was some added expenses that were associated with bringing on this administrative assistant person.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I can tell you that there's no added expenses other than that $65,000 to bring on that.
I didn't hear his question.
Sir, do you have another testifier?
I'm sorry. Yes, I'd like to introduce Dan Boydham. He's my fiscal advisor.
That's second. John Wolf, our fiscal analyst, will address that movie.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dean, you can see on the top line of their budget page under the general fund, there's a balance forward in from the previous year. So that was money that was rolled forward from the first year of the budget into the second year of the budget that artificially brought that second year up.
Does that help, or do you want some more clarification?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Walls. It helps, but then I'm curious how that's getting incorporated moving forward in the forecasted budget.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, it's customary practice and allowed in statute that an agency may move money that's left over from the first year into the second year to pay certain expenses. And then if there's money left over in the second year, unless they have carry-forward authority, those remaining balances cancel to the general fund.
Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, now I understand a little better. So just to understand what had happened, in hiring my administrative assistant, it actually took 6 months to get her on board, and we had some salary savings. And so we've utilized some of that money for some other items. We had to buy new computers, for example, because our IT department would not service ours anymore. They were so out of date. And some training and things like that. But I think that might be what you're referring to.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Constantine, you have a question?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair. I'm kind of wondering why we put money into this at all and why this isn't strictly a fee-based pay-for-service. There are 9,000 members, and I'm wondering why we're using tax dollars to supplement this.
Mr. Chair,
those are all philosophical questions.
if I could just make a point. You know, this is an industry where you have people carrying guns. They're providing protective services. We have investigators that are obtaining sensitive information, and this is a industry that deems some regulation, if you will, with some of that criteria to make sure that people are abiding by our statutes and so on and so forth. That's about the only I think, say towards that.
What was... Oh, go ahead.
And I am not actually debating the necessity for the board. I'm just talking about how to pay for it. Yes, I think that what you provide is a necessary service. They need oversight. Just strictly, why isn't the fees paying for the funding rather than coming out of the general fund?
Mr. Clark, I would imagine the answer would be that the fees collected wouldn't come anywhere near close to your budget, or go ahead.
Mr. Chair, well, actually, we're with the revenue increasing, we are seeing sort of a balance between the revenues and the costs involved. What we're looking at now is, you know, some other avenues of possibly with some statute revisions and adding on some fees. We had talked last time I presented to you about possibly looking at charging fees for training certification. That's a large chunk of money that we missed. Some states, they charge for testing, and you have to have a test in order to get a license. So I will note that, you know, I did talk to the Department of Employment, and they had stated, Department of Revenue, and they had stated that this industry is putting in somewhere between $12 and $16 million worth of tax revenue into the system, but they're still trying to clarify that. But I do understand what the representative is stating.
I understand now your question better, Representative Considine.
Yes, Mr. Chair, it looks like in 2014 they brought in $180,000, so it would be about $9,000 short of what their budget request. 2016, it's $160,000, so with a couple of tweaks, it looks to me like they could be self-sufficient.
Any members? Question? All right. Are you anything left, sir?
That's it.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Cook.
Thank you.
Tomorrow we have the judicial branch in front of us. That's our only and I forgot. I'm sorry. Our researcher, David Anderson, has joined us. Now will be our new researcher for our the committee. So give him a welcome hand. Thank you, David. All right, and with that, meeting adjourned.